I'm Tom Miner. I'm one of the co-moderators for this session, along with Ann Mosenthal. I'll be introducing and we'll be summarizing. So that's how we're going to break this up. Welcome to Getting to Know. I'd like to thank everyone for indulging me on the title. I thought about this way back years ago with two of my mentors, Dave Jakes and Dan Coit. And there's some popular press and business, Getting to Yes. It was in there, How Not to Look Weak in Negotiations was the subtitle on it. And that didn't quite work for end-of-life discussions, but it got us thinking. And then the business literature changed to getting beyond no, how to look for more than just the no's. So that's really what started this. And I guess I've always been intrigued by the wordplay, getting to know, saying no for surgery, but then getting to know, knowing our patients, knowing ourselves. It was a good checkpoint as I thought about it for those facts, those hard realities that we often get on these difficult consults, oftentimes at the end of life. I've always thought of these as among the hardest things we do in surgery. It takes the highest level of clinical judgment to say no. In fact, my partners and I, when we talk to our residents, saying committing to an operation is the easy part. Saying no is the real epitome of surgical excellence. So it's in that spirit that we talk about this. We often get these consults. We also get these recommendations to see patients where sometimes we get frustrated. A couple of talks yesterday, I heard people talking about getting angry or incredulous. How could they ask us? This is so stupid. The fact is, these are people in need. These are consultants in needs. These are peers in needs. These are patients and families in needs. And I think we have to bring that recognition into the patients and the consultations as we need them. These are as much as needy patients as the exsanguinating patient, the free air patient, whatever surgical emergency you can think of. The other thing that makes these difficult is that we're often not equipped with the skills required to excel in this area. Communication skills are incredibly difficult in this, and we're often challenged by this. Data are lacking. Oftentimes we'll get the call from the resident and he or she will go to the risk calculators, right, and say there's an 80% chance of death. Well, one of the things we have to remember, but that all these risk calculators only look at those people selected for operation. They don't include those patients who we do not take to operation. The fact is we don't know what happened with them often. Sometimes in the acute setting we might be able to extrapolate and predict pretty accurate what's going to happen. But how about in the cancer patient or the vascular patient or the complex neurosurgical patient? There's many examples where our data are lacking, particularly making this challenging. So we hope to confront some of these issues today with our speakers and hopefully be able to answer many of these questions, or at least what we can in the questions that follow. So welcome and thank you for coming. Our first speaker, we'll talk about the ethical considerations of not offering an operative intervention. I'd like to invite Dr. White to the podium. Thank you.
Tom, thank you very much.
We're going to start with this one down here. Oh, that third one. Thank you. Great.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate being invited to participate in the session today. I'm a thoracic surgeon just down the road at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. I've been involved with ethics for a while, and last year I was fortunate enough to do a one-year fellowship in bioethics at Harvard. I got a wealth of information out of that, and I've been asked to talk about the ethical perspective of turning down a patient for surgery or getting to know. I don't have any disclosures along these lines. And I thought that with an audience like this, that there's probably a fairly wide range of background knowledge and understanding of how to approach an ethical dilemma. I think for the most part, we kind of understand when we're asked what's the right thing to do. 95% of the time, we kind of know what the right thing to do is. And I think for the most part, most people are going to be on the same page. However, there are times where it's not that clear. And that's where the role of understanding the ethics comes into play. So you have to think about what is the right thing to do under a certain situation. And not only that, but you may have to justify that. It's fine to understand to yourself what the right thing to do is, but we don't work in an isolated environment. We work with other people. So often we may be called on not to just come up with an answer, but to be able to justify why we came up with that solution to a problem. So I thought I'd sort of take it back a little bit, get into a couple of definitions, a little about the theoretical basis of how one comes to some of these decisions, and then give you three fairly concrete examples of how to apply some of the ethical background and ethical theories that may be applicable to a situation where it's not that clear what to do. So first, definitions, ethics, ways to examine and understand moral life, ways to look at that question, what's the right thing to do, and how to analyze it and understand it and be able to justify what we come up with. Morals, beliefs concerning right and wrong, and norms, or a standard way, or a standard or usual pattern of behavior. So these are terms that come up all the time in ethical discussions, and there's two sort of broad types of ethics. There's normative ethics, which seeks to create or evaluate moral standards. It's an attempt to figure out what people should do and whether moral behavior is acceptable. So this is sort of what's the right thing to do, but there's another way of looking at ethics, and that's descriptive ethics, which describes how people actually behave. And there may be a variance between what they claim to do, say, is the right thing to do, and what they actually do. Empirical ethics is descriptive ethics, doesn't necessarily evaluate things, but it says, in a situation, how do people actually behave? And one of the three case examples is going to illustrate that, I think, quite well. So when you look at normative ethics, there's essentially two major schools of thought. What is the right thing to do? How do you determine something is the right thing to do? You can look at whether is it duty-based or consequential-based, and we'll hit upon that briefly. Duty-based, otherwise known as or termed as deontological, looks at duties. What are our duties to other people? And I think when you drill this down, some of the simple things or examples might be the golden rule, do unto others as you would have done unto you, or some modern English variant of that. But that's a simple way to look at things. The Ten Commandments, do not kill, do not lie, cheat, steal, so on and so forth. We have duties to our fellow man to do things or not do things. These all sound very good, but in actuality, sometimes it's not quite clear what is stealing, what is the right thing to do. And these duties are not necessarily in rank order. And sometimes one has to balance one duty against another. The concept of duty-based ethics, sort of primarily pioneered by Immanuel Kant back in the 1700s and the 18th century, depended at least on some concept of a moral absolute. What is really the right thing to do? And one would say, you shouldn't kill. You shouldn't kill ever. Now, we understand that that's a nice way to think about things, but we have wars. People are killed or hurt in the course of self-defense. Does that mean is do not kill a moral absolute, or is it a relative? And obviously, when you poll people, some people are conscientious objectors and will say it's a moral absolute. Others take a more nuanced view of things. So that's the sort of duty-based ethics, and it's a fairly good foundation for coming up with some of the things that we should do or shouldn't do with respect to our relationships with our patients. Consequentialism, on the other hand, bases the rightness or wrongness of things based on the outcome, not necessarily what you should do, but what is the actual outcome of what happens. Is an act right or wrong because it's inherently right or wrong, or because it produces bad things? And one of the questions this obviously brings up is, how can you predict what's going to happen? We don't have particularly good crystal balls. So that obviously introduces a bit of ambiguity into it and uncertainty into what is the right thing, because you simply don't know what will definitely happen as a result of your actions. One of the subtypes of consequentialism is utilitarianism. It's probably the most commonly used or employed aspect of consequentialism. And basically it says that we should seek the greatest good for the greatest number of people. And this is a very simple concept, and it makes perfect sense. And I was recently at the Connolly Lecture, and Michael Porter talked about this, but in a sense, in his value-based talking, and it sort of struck me that he's talking about a very utilitarian system where one has to allocate healthcare resources to get the most value for the most people. That is essentially the essence of utilitarianism. So one has to be able to predict how much happiness you're going to get, how much happiness you're going to take away, but essentially that this is the concept of it. It's not perfect, but it's an alternative theory to the duty-based. And the classic example of utilitarianism is this little cartoon on the right. There's a trolley or a train coming down the track. It's going to go. It's lost control. The brakes don't work. You're standing at this little switch. And if you pull the switch, the train gets diverted and it goes onto the other track where there's one guy sitting there and he's going to get run over, versus if you don't do anything, four people are going to get killed. So you have a choice, you have a moral choice. What's the right thing to do? Am I going to let four people die, or am I going to act, do something and let one person die? So when you poll people, the most common answer is you would pull the switch and the train would go down the track and one person would get hurt versus four people, and that's a strictly utilitarian approach. It kind of breaks down a little bit when you take a little twist on this. And now imagine you're on a bridge and there's a guy standing in front of you, a very big guy, a guy that if he falls off the bridge, he would be able to stop that trolley. So now you got four people there. Now, while most people were relatively comfortable pulling the switch and diverting the train to one person, what about pushing the guy off? Is that an okay thing to do? Essentially, it's the same thing as the other one, one person versus four people. But when you poll people on this, most people say it's not okay to do that. It's okay to pull the switch and divert the train to one person, but it's not okay to push the other guy off the bridge and stop the train. Now, I mean, obviously on a utilitarian view, they're the same thing, right? One person versus four, same thing. However, this is where one of the ways that this system breaks down, because when you actually pull people, while they may be comfortable pulling the switch, they are not comfortable pushing the guy off the bridge. So none of these things are perfect. That's one of the take-home points. But there's a well-known, probably the standard book on biomedical ethics, at least in the US. It's written by Beecham and Childress. It's now the 7th or 8th edition, I'm not quite sure which. And it talks about biomedical ethics and how we apply ethics to our world as physicians and surgeons. And basically, they come up with there are four essential principles of biomedical ethics. And many people know about these. There's respect for autonomy or respect for persons. Beneficence, we're trying to help people. Non-maleficence, essentially do no harm. We shouldn't hurt people. And justice, the concept of fairness. And I think that all of these are motherhood and apple pie. They make perfect sense, and they are sort of the foundation for our current U.S. Western biomedical ethics system. Now, one of the things that Beecham and Childress fail to do on this, and when you apply these principles, is how do you prioritize these? Because sometimes you can't find one solution that fits every one of these. So you've got to sort of pick and choose a little bit. But those two authors went on to further define, based on those principles, what they consider to be tenets or the hallmarks of a physician-patient relationship. And those are veracity, privacy, and confidentiality, which are obviously pretty closely related, but not perhaps exactly the same thing, and fidelity or a fiduciary relationship to your patient. Veracity is truth-telling, comprehensive, active, and objective transmission of information. I think we all try to do that for the most part. Privacy and confidentiality, again, relate similar but slightly different concepts, having to do with keeping information and decisions private. And fidelity, faithfulness to your patient, putting the patient's interests first. And I think for the most part we do that, but that's a very idealistic situation. And we do try to put our patients first for the most part, but one of the things that came up in a conversation just yesterday was, what if you have multiple patients? I mean, we actually do allocate this fidelity and allocate some of this our time to other patients. It's not just everybody gets one. So those are the principles. And the three cases I want to illustrate, here's the first one. Elderly man undergoes elective vascular surgery, has a complicated course, ends up in the ICU, becomes septic, taken to the OR for a laparotomy, has a necrotic segment of bowel that was taken out, goes back to the next day and for a second look operation. Now he's got extensive small bowel necrosis, and the decision was made to close and put the patient on comfort measures. So you have to ask, what's the ethical basis for this? When there are, in fact, alternatives such as prolonged TPN and bowel transplant, we sort of say, Mr. Smith, he's old, he's not going to do well, he's going to die, and we're going to close things up and go talk to the family. But in fact, there are technical alternatives to that, and we're making a judgment as to which we do. Do we do the comfort measures, or do we embark on this far more aggressive approach, and how do we decide that? When do you decide if a case is futile, and what do you do in the situation where the family wants everything done? Do you sort of talk them out of it? I mean, this is where, obviously, these sort of ethical liaison teams come into play. But if you break it down in terms of those ethical principles by Beecham and Childress, you sort of come up with this respect for autonomy. What would the patient have wanted? Sometimes that people know, sometimes they don't. And when you don't know what the patient wants, there's this concept of substituted judgment, which is that brought up the judgment of the family on the part of the patient. Beneficence. Will ongoing treatment really help the patient? Are we prolonging death or are we prolonging life? And what is the probability of success? Or are we really at this point of futile care? We've all seen this sort of picture with the person in the ICU with multiple drips going in a ventilator. And basically, you know what's going to happen down the line. But it's your job to sort of have the hash out this discussion with the family and make the, quote, right decision. Is there a harm to the patient to doing this? Well, there's a loss of dignity. There's a loss of autonomy. There's a major loss of quality of life. So you have to balance this by keeping going. Are you actually hurting the patient? And then another thing you want to think about is the justice side of things, which is this equitable distribution of resources? And sometimes many of these resources are scarce. And the second example we'll show you a very scarce resource, but one has to think about that. In case two, this is a slight adaptation of a real situation that happened a number of years ago. But imagine you're a critical care person in charge of an ICU with a young man, self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. He's heading toward brain death criteria, but his lungs are perfect. And you're a thoracic surgeon and a critical care person. And you have a young woman in the hospital with cystic fibrosis who's listed for lung transplantation, appropriate size match, blood match for that donor. And you think she's going downhill, but right now, her pulmonary function tests would suggest that she probably would not get those lungs, even though they're a perfect match. Imagine you had the ability to simply make her a top priority and allocate the lungs to her. Should you do this? And in a more realistic situation, and we see this sometimes in the world of transplantation, that the patient's clinical condition is actually manipulated a little bit to sort of drive them to a higher status. Distasteful or not, I think that happens. So you can use some of those principles to look at that, the physician-patient relationship, the veracity, the privacy, the confidentiality, but probably most important in this example is the fidelity. What's the obligation to your patient, that young woman with cystic fibrosis? The young man with a head injury is going to go on to brain death, and his organs are presumably going to go to somebody. But what's the obligation to your patient, and what do you need to do to justify serving her best interests? And what is your obligation to potentially other transplant recipients? If you look at this in terms of the principles of autonomy, beneficence, and so on, beneficence, what benefits do you get to your patients? But most importantly here is the concept of justice. And what is the fair distribution of these scarce resources? And this could potentially put someone in a pretty difficult situation if they were allowed to make that. But fortunately, we do have rules. And the situation that came up with respect to lung allocation a number of years ago was a lung allocation score, which basically allocates lungs to maximize survival based on age, diagnosis, severity, and functional status. So you look at how long would somebody survive without a lung transplant versus how long they would live with a transplant. You look at that difference. And if you have a short survival without a transplant and a long survival with a transplant, you get a high score. You get the lung or the lungs. On the other hand, if you're on the other end of the spectrum, unfortunate, you don't get them, but those are the rules of the game. This is a purely utilitarian approach to this. This is maximizing the greatest good for the greatest number of people. The third example is a situation that, I'm a thoracic surgeon, I don't do cardiac anymore, but this is a fairly common situation for heart surgeons. Young person, Hep C positive IV drug abuser, multiple medical issues, lupus, dialysis, has had a couple of episodes of aortic valve endocarditis, and this is a real scenario based on a conversation I had with a friend of mine just 2 weeks ago. Two AVRs in the past 3 years, both dealt with by valve replacement and prolonged inpatient antibiotics. The second AVR, 10-hour operation, plus a take-back, multiple transfusions, long ICU stay, sent off to rehab with a poor quality of life, both operations by the same surgeon who advised the patient that he may not be a candidate for a third operation if he continues to abuse drugs. Not surprisingly, the person continued to abuse drugs, marginal compliance medications, and now comes back in the hospital, this time with an episode of tricuspid valve endocarditis, severe heart failure, and early cirrhosis. Should he have a third valve replacement? So you can, again, examine this in terms of the various principles, in terms of respect for autonomy. You know, the patient can decide. He can choose his lifestyle. But on the one hand, you choose your lifestyle, you sort of have to accept the consequences that go along with it. One has to think about what's the likelihood of success with that third operation. I mean, it's probably going to be harder and more risky than the second operation. Plus the fact that as the surgeon, you told the person, this is your second chance. You're not getting another operation. He went on to continue doing things that put him in a bad situation. What's the likelihood of harm? I mean, again, higher than the second operation, high risk of stroke, substantial risk of death with the operation, low chance of getting to a substantially good quality of life. And then you've got this concept of justice. Is it fair to allocate all of those resources to a person who has obviously not sort of complied with things? Taking on that case will consume substantial additional resources in terms of dollars, the surgeon's time, hospital resources, which in certain situations may not be available to other patients. So the story of that was the patient was discussed at the joint conference. Recommendation was to him to have a third valve replacement. He's young, deserves another chance, so on and so forth. Can't turn him down because you as a surgeon have a possible Hep C exposure. The surgeon says, no, this is too risky. He won't do well. I talked to him about this before. He's gonna, even if he survives, odds are if he makes it out of a hospital rehab, he's gonna continue to abuse drugs. And the surgeon said, no, I'm not doing it. Patient went back to the committee and the recommendation changed. Well, the first surgeon said, well, I got partners. I mean, you guys on the committee, why don't you guys do that case? I mean, I'm not doing it, but you go ahead and do it. You're convinced it's the right thing to do. You can see what happened. The tables turned and the revised recommendation was he's not a candidate for surgery. So the committee has what one of my former mentors called the courage of the non-combatant. This really illustrates this difference between normative ethics and empirical ethics. What should you do? This is some group saying, what should you do? Well, when the tables are turned, it's what was done or what you should do versus what I will do. So those are some of the ways to examine these on an ethical basis. So thank you very much.